Hey, everybody, welcome to the podcast. Before we get into our guests this week, this coming weekend, Friday and Saturday, November 25th and 26th, right after Thanksgiving, I'm headlining at Gotham Comedy Club here in New York City. So if you're in the New York area and you're sick and tired of hanging out with your relatives, and frankly, come on, we all are, come check out a show. I've got two shows Friday, three Saturday, November 25th, 26th, Gotham Comedy Club, beautiful supper club here in New York City on 23rd Street. And because you listen to this podcast, they're giving you a discount, half off the tickets. Go to GothamComedyClub.com, insert the promo code Paul, P-A-U-L, all caps, and you get half off the tickets. Cheap night of comedy, and a few drinks, and then you go back, eat leftover turkey, and everybody's happy. My guest this week, Dave Attell, good, longtime friend, brilliant comic, the comics comic. Dave rarely does long-form interviews. Really, really special to have him in a really cool conversation that covers everything from how he got started in stand-up, going to NYU, where he thinks stand-up is these days as an art form, how he approaches writing. Just a really fascinating conversation with probably the most brilliant comic working today, and I don't overstate that. November 25th and 26th, Gotham Comedy Club. Go to GothamComedyClub.com, get some tickets, use the promo code Paul, you get half off. And thanks for checking out the podcast, and see you next week.
Paul, thank you for having me on your podcast. What is the name of the podcast?
The name is Two Chairs and a Microphone.
Is that really what it is?
Yeah.
No way that you... That's a great name, but how did you get that? Has Beck been on yet?
Yeah. I knew you were going to do it.
No, I mean, honestly, that's a great name.
I just played around with names. I was doing the Paul Mercurio show, and then we switched it over, and I was like, I want to do something that's a little more catchy, whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm a marketing genius, Dave. A lot of people don't realize that.
I love it.
And what? You have a giant duffel bag. You have heads in there? What's going on?
No, I'm in between laundry and my kettlebells, which you constantly will never let go of.
Yeah.
When I do kettlebells.
Yes.
You constantly question me.
How's it going?
It's
You're looking a little more ripped. I see veins in your arms now.
I'm just doubling up on shirts. It's so much easier. Other people do supplements. I just wear flannel on top of a hoodie.
Do you wear like a Jane Fonda, like some kind of a headband when you work out?
I would, if that would help.
Because
I don't know what happened to the headbands. You don't see them that much. Only in like young adult movies, like PG-13, where like the guy is fat but he's working out. Became like a kind of like I'm telling a joke. I have a headband on.
It's to let people know that he's working out in case they miss the part where he's actually
working
out. For
the international sales. But who am I saying this to? The marketing genius, Paul Mercurio, and his two chairs and a microphone.
Yeah. Do you wish you had a podcast?
No, you remember we were talking about this? We actually had, just for the listeners at home, Eric, I would say, is like the one listener.
Wait a minute.
We had a great talk in the cab where we talked all about the business side of the business.
Yeah.
And that's what I like about, when I get to like, because I go on the road, you go on the road, but when we get back, we all get to like exchange notes.
Yeah,
of
exactly.
The, it's almost like we're fishermen and we come back and it's like, I can't believe there's more regulation. Oh my God, they cut out. Wow, you can't fish on 4th of July? Oh man. Boat insurance is way up.
You're not allowed to shoot them? That's bullshit.
Yeah, like no dynamite fishing? What
the fuck? So, yeah, I mean, we were talking about podcasts and social media, and I'm of the school, social media has sort of been this invention, like a robot that was going to do good for comedy, and I think it's done more bad than good. Do you like that?
I kind of agree with that.
Dane Cook figured out the model, which good for him.
Right.
And a lot of people sort of then fill that, like, got in line, and like, I'm going to do it. But I think all the clubs rely on it way too much to promote. They don't want to have any radio relationships because they don't want to pay to have the comics on and to advertise,
right,
which is what we were talking about. Mm-hmm. And I think the biggest part of it is I think the audience, I really don't need you. I could just do this into the microphone. You can just nod and
No, I'm agreeing so far.
And audiences are already inherently judgmental, and over the years I'm sure you've seen a change. Where now, like, I think they feel like they're entitled to an opinion just because they are on social media. Like, everybody in social media has empowered people to have opinions when they shouldn't, right? So
right.
I feel like the audiences have sort of been affected in a negative way by it, too.
The feedback was what everybody was like, it's immediate feedback, and we all thought that was going to be great.
Right.
But it turns out it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
It's also, like, for me, a 50-year-old man, it's kind of creepy.
Yeah.
It's also... It's a never-ending cycle of where you know, like first it was Facebook, you know, like there's all these different platforms, and then it became, you know, like, it's like there's always that one guy, I think he's everywhere, the one guy who's like, hey, how come you're not on Instagram?
Right.
Hey, how come you're not on this? Right. Like, he just kind of travels around. Right. I think he's paid, like, just to tell old people, like, to scare old people, you know? I think, can I just say one thing, Paul? Because yeah. I think that you're, like, a family guy and you're a good guy. You fight the good fight. But, like, I text my mother, and she never texts me back. And I know it's not because she's, like, busy. It's, she just doesn't understand it. I've explained it to her. My sister has explained it to her. And it's really funny because, like, what she does is she denies that I texted her. And I think that's great because that, like, activates all my childhood, like, problems of, like, no one's listening to me. And I really think it's funny that, like, eventually we don't have that out now. Like, we can't say that, like, oh, the technology, you know, I don't know. Because
right.
we're supposedly, like, you know, tech savvy, I right. guess, up until you're, I
well,
guess,
my
age.
But kids will pull that bullshit. My kid pulls it, like, I just didn't see it. Mm-hmm. Or I'll call him. Like, I literally, we will text, right?
Yeah.
And nobody wants to talk on the phone anymore.
Yeah, I
like,
don't.
Like, I've had an agent's assistant email her, said, could you give me a call? I left a message, didn't hear from her. Emailed her 10 minutes later, could you call me? Emails me back, what is it about? I'm like, I'm not going to tell you what it's about. Call me. Can you tell me what it's about? It was 5 emails. I had to call the agent and go, never have that assistant do that again.
Yeah.
She needs to call and talk. People don't, it's weird. They want to engage, but on their own terms. They want to be on Instagram and Vine and Facebook mm-hmm. and Twitter, mm-hmm. but they don't want to do this one-on-one thing anymore. My son will I'll text him, and then 2 minutes later I'll call him, and he doesn't pick up the phone. And I go, fucking ape shit. He goes, well, I didn't hear the phone. Well, you just had the phone in your hand.
Right.
So they use their sort of lack of, like, focus as a fucking excuse.
Yeah, exactly.
And your mother, my mother doesn't even know how to
text. Is my mother texting you? That's what I'm really,
she is.
That's why I'm here today.
She is. She's asking, wait, how's Dave's kettlebell workout? But by the way, is it true you smoke during the workout?
You can. But only if you do it outside.
Wait.
No, the beauty of it is like, I think kettlebells is like some kind of Russian prison workout. So, like, I think it's anything goes. But
why not barbells? What is the advantage of kettlebells?
The kettlebell thing is because it's also aerobic. Like, you can swing them around. And the guy who I train with, Coach Fury, by the way, mm-hmm. an amazing guy. He
is that really
holds he holds records in, like, lifting these kettlebells, which I'm not even there yet. The majority of my workout, and by the way, you know, being so old and, like, you know, I drank so heavily and smoke and all that kind of stuff, is that a lot of it is really just, like, what you can't do. Like, move your arm around. Oh, that arm doesn't go down anymore. Okay. Let's see what your legs are up to today. What? Throbbing? Okay. Then we better do. So it's really always crossing off. And it really just sits there like, hey, how about I watch you make a sandwich? You know? But that's really what it is. And I started doing kettlebells because, you know, like, my doctor goes, you know, your cholesterol is really, really high. And I was like, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah, you're not. Well, I guess I was
going
to say
you're not heavy. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. No, I'm like, you got to be kidding me. Because it was like, you know, like, of like, you know, I always think of, like, high cholesterol as a win. Like, you know, you're like a really, like, award-winning salesman. You eat a lot of steaks, you know. And I'm like, oh, God. So then they always want to get you on, like, some kind of, like, you know, lowering thing.
Medication.
And I say, there's no way I'm doing that. Yeah. You know, it's like, I'm not going to do it.
Well, why would you have high cholesterol? You don't eat. I've
always been a fat kid. I don't know if you, I think you're genetically thin, plus you probably did some kind of Rhode Island sport. Were you a sailor? Were you on a 12-man crew?
I would fish with my
schooner?
Hands. I would fish with my hands in a small boat with a sail.
Well, I'm trying to think of the other Rhode Island things.
Coffee milk,
a lot
clam
of
cakes.
No.
No. RISD, a lot of raping. We rape in Providence.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's the Italian way.
RISD, which was, by the way, always the...
How do you know about RISD?
I lived with 7 guys from Rhode Island. Did you ever see that one-man show?
No.
I lived with 7 guys. That's the name of my podcast. No, I lived with all these guys from Rhode Island. They were the coolest guys. They all moved to New York, went to NYU or whatever, and that's where I went to school. And then they, you know, like, would tell me about the Rhode Island world, which you know, it was always cooler than what I, you know, because Boston gets all the attention.
Right.
But Rhode Island really is kind of like the, you know, the cool.
Well,
the
Family
cool
Guy's actually a good reflection of the state. Like, it really is like that. And then, like, a little bit of crime is okay. Like, Buddy Cianci was our mayor, and he's a guy was cheating on his wife was cheating on him with some guy.
Right.
So he had his trooper, who drove him around, state trooper, take him to a abandoned warehouse, and Buddy himself rolled up his sleeves, slapped the guy around, pissed on the guy and put a cigarette on the guy. The guy brought charges. They convicted Buddy, the mayor. He didn't serve. He hung around, went on radio, then went up for re-election, won in a landslide, and they asked this old Italian woman on Federal Hill, like, why would you vote for him? He goes, hey, the guy was messing around with his wife. He deserved what he got.
Yeah.
And that's the mentality.
You guys like that mentality.
Yeah. That. It's like a little bit of crime is okay.
It's like kind of Boston, kind of Staten Island, yeah. Somewhere in between.
But you weren't, I never remember you as fat even when you
I was a fat kid, I was a fat man, and I remember when I was like in my early 20s, I wanted to,
Here comes the beer. That's the beer.
That's my, we're at the
We're at the Comedy Cellar, by the way, yeah. Doing this podcast, so they're getting a beer delivery. So this will give you the real feel for how, and we're doing it during the day, so this gives you a feel for how the business works. You were like a loner as a kid?
Yeah. Right. No, I had friends, but I felt my alone time was very precious to me.
I grew up in a
really nice house with not enough room. Like, I had roommates. Like, not roommates, my brothers. And, like, we lived in bunk beds. And, like, to this day, my younger brother, who was my bunk mate, you know, my celly, I guess you would say, for the kids, you know, he was always like, man, you masturbated a lot. And I was like, what?
Come on.
He's like, you were sleeping the whole time. Like, yeah, but come on, we're in bunk beds.
It's in my eye.
Yeah, so bunk beds, not food times. That was way before that.
We would have hung out if we knew each other as kids, don't you think?
I don't know about that. I feel like you were on a crew. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, that's... That actually sounds like a bowling machine went bad. Like, there's a pin
exactly.
Stuck and a hand.
That's two kegs with bottles on top.
But,
No?
No, I don't think so. I think that you were, weren't you more like, I see you more like on the debating team, that you were pushed into, the honors classes.
No, when I was in high school, I was a fuck-off. It was when I got to college. Yeah, I used to get thrown out of class a lot.
What'd your dad do? Or dads? I don't know. You never know anymore.
It's, the court tells me that he put floors in front of me.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, my mother has a furniture store, and then they ran the furniture store together.
Sorry.
And,
are we wearing battle armor? Are we also jousting?
Hang on, bullets
this
are coming.
This is kind of what kettlebell sounds yeah. Like, a lot of dropping. And oh.
Did you, why, by the way, so I did, I was okay in high school. Mm. But you weren't a fuck off, were you?
I wasn't smart, and I think that was another thing that, I find so interesting about comedy now is that when I first started comedy, it was really a lot of guys and ladies who, like, they had done other things and they kind of all kind of failed at them. You know, there was the occasional lawyer mm-hmm. or, like, you know, the guy who was a professor who
yeah.
was doing it. But the majority of them were just, like, really dopes, you know, who, like, were really kind of in flux, had no, I mean, there were some, like, natural, gifted performer people, but I think that the majority of them were just, like, people like me who really were aimless, who were not good at anything else.
Well, when
I was never good
at
sports, and I was never good at school.
Didn't you try sales when you came out of college?
Yeah, but I'm a master salesman. Mm-hmm. No, I was selling shoes, and my dad's...
You? I
my
can't
dad,
see.
My dad had a bridal and tuxedo rental store, mm-hmm. and that was really good. And to this day, I was like, you know, I was so lucky I got to work with my dad, and I also got to work... in sales when I was young because, like, it kind of helped me, like, learn about people.
Yeah.
And every job I've had since then, I think, has been, you know, kind of like you know, like, those skills sometimes come into play. But seeing how my dad, like, a real, like, a man,
yeah.
you know, like a madman type, you know, guy,
yeah.
like, really, you know, like, handle himself and stuff, that was, like, precious. I'm still thankful that I got to do that, you know.
Even though
I gave up some amazing, great years of partying. Being 16, you know, it's like I have to go clean a store with my friends. They're all doing bong hits in somebody's basement.
Yeah, it's the same thing with me.
You know, I was like, hey, we're going to go to this, you know, whatever, like a warehouse and like huff paint. You know, I missed all those those kind of things.
But I did the same thing. Saturdays, we used to have to deliver furniture, and all my friends were out playing, hanging out, whatever. And mm-hmm. I was delivering furniture with my father and my brother. My brother and I lived in bunk beds. And he would masturbate, and it would go up. It would actually up curve around. Oh, look, and now they're bringing them up. See, they want to get it both ways.
I love that there's, like, a distraction during the podcast.
Yes.
It makes us focus the conversation.
Exactly.
And the listener has to try just a little longer. I feel sorry for the listener because they're driving in their car. They're thinking, there's something wrong with my car. That's my transmission sound.
I can't.
There's a knock in my...
Would you learn as a salesman?
What I learned?
That you're taking, that you
is
use
that,
now.
Because you can never really sell anybody who doesn't want to be sold. I think that was one of them. The other one is that, you know, confidence goes further than knowledge sometimes.
Yeah.
Like saying and thinking, you know, a lot of people come in where they're like, they want to buy something, they're just not sure. And then there's that, like, fine point where they realize that you're selling them and you have to pull back on that. But the majority of the sales things was just like, I saw a lot of women's feet, which was erotic for a boy.
And that's your favorite kind of porn, right?
You know what? That's the one porn I don't like, is foot fetish.
Why?
I used to try and do jokes on it, foot fetish.
Nothing?
Nothing. And that's the one thing that, you know, like when we talk about like porn and everything like that, porn, I think, you know, because I was going to say to you, like, you're on the road, you know, like, and I'm sure you're in a cool relationship with your wife where, like, she doesn't mind you looking at a little porn, you know?
Yeah.
And now that Playboy magazine is going PG-13, what are we going to do?
Yeah, I don't know.
I haven't looked at that magazine since Vietnam. I haven't, who cares? Like, you open a Hustler, and you look at it, and you're like, wow, man, this is what it's about.
That's exactly, I'm surprised I haven't been going out of business. Do you miss doing your, Dave's old porn show?
I miss it. I love doing that
show. Why did you stop doing
it? You would have been on it. I like how people always think, I stopped doing it. The network didn't pick it up anymore.
Well, did they not pick it up because you were about to put me on it and just to fuck me?
I'm glad that you saw it that way, because people who come up to me, first of all, that would have been a show where there was a wealth of iconic, cool adult stars. And there was like the new wave of stars who were also very cool. Right. And then there was all the comics who I know appreciate and love porn. So it was like one of these like never-ending pools of talent.
Right.
And then there was all this great retro stuff, which I still look at today. Like, I'm always looking for all these crazy dramatic scenes in porn. And then I was like, you know, the network said, okay, well, we are going a different direction. And the direction they went in was the, you know, it was for Showtime. So it was the male escort show, whatever that show is. That's the one, because it was, like, dramatic.
Yeah.
And, like, it was all scripted and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, yeah, that was the one I put a ton of time, money, and also just like, I feel like I put like my soul in that one, because I really was into the idea. I thought it was a cool idea.
Well, but can't you do it on digital maybe and do it on the web?
I could do a lot of things. What are you, like some guy meeting at a merch table? I could do a trillion things. I just don't have the money right now to do it all
the time.
Hey, Dave,
how come you're not on TV?
And the other thing is that, like, you know, people don't realize that, like, once you... Like, I own the show, but they still have all the rights to it. So, you know, it's like one of those things where, like, you have to kind of wait till you get the rights back.
Right.
And I have shows that have not been edited. Doug Stanhope's in one of them. Mm-hmm. Mitch Fatel, the great, you know, Otto and George.
Oh,
Otto
yeah.
is in them. And, like, I can't really edit them until I get the rights to do it.
And,
you know, money-wise, like, I don't mind throwing my money at these things, but it's just, like, time-wise, it gets harder and harder as you get, you know, I guess, older and older.
Do you... Getting into stand-up, right?
Yeah.
What, I mean, I know you said, and you tend to be super modest and self-deprecating, and I don't know why, because everybody else puts you down anyway, so why do it to yourself? But we're both staring at somebody going to the bathroom.
No, it's funny, because like now, it's like we're in the eye of the hurricane. Who knows what the next distraction
This is what I like about a podcast, is you get anything
happens.
You
never know. Yeah.
So, what was it about stand-up that... You know, kind of, because the thing that surprised me about you is you pretty much keep to yourself. I mean, you're social to a certain extent off stage, but I'd say a little more introverted than most people. But you know, obviously you're a stand-up and you're a great stand-up, and I do mean that. That you're great.
Oh, that's very nice of you to say.
So, okay, this is getting awkward. You also like boys and you diddle them right there. Now that feels like more. So, what was it? When you decided to try and open mic, like, what, I was always curious about that. Like, what was it that intrigued you about that?
All right. Open mics are a good example of, you know, like I said, there was a lot of people who were, like, not aimless, you know, and I think Patton has a great joke about Patton Oswalt, who's actually such a good guy and also, like, super creative. Just, you know, I can't say enough good about that guy, because... He stands up for all comedy, I think, sometimes. And it's good to see, like, there is, like, you know, I guess you could say, like, a Knight Templar in the world.
Stand up in the sense of, in terms of the
like
the purity
with the PC,
of it?
Yeah. You know, with the PC and the whole, like, reading into a joke just to look, just to criticize or to, you know, find whatever the moment, like, he's very good at that, of like, kind of basically... standing up for the purity and I guess you could say just like the rawness of what comedy should be and the you know, if there is an art to it, then he definitely, you know, has a great vision of that. But to get back to your point, he used to do his joke about, you know, I miss the open mics where they would have like all these, you know, like characters would show up. Like there'd be a guy show up, he's like coming off of heroin, or another guy is, you know, like whatever. He would show up, and he, for some reason, he would have like, you know, he'd be holding like a water cooler in his hand. You know, like that was his. So there was the open mics in New York, I think, were very, they weren't clicky like I think they are now.
Yeah.
They were pretty much fighting for stage time,
yeah,
for an audience that was mostly comics, which is how it's always
going to
be.
You remember downtown Beirut too? Do you remember that place?
I don't remember that as much as I remember like mostly Magic, and you know, there was a couple of other.
That's where I met Rick Shapiro at one of those.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, like just, but you're right. Like I think the click at every level now exists between alternative comedy and club comedy, and I don't like that at all. I think that a comic should be able to work any room, and the whole point of stand-up is to be open-minded about things, and then suddenly these clicks started fucking forming where you have to have plaid shirts and black ironic glasses and a beard, and you're like halfway there. You're already turning over.
Yes.
But doesn't that bother you that the comedy scene has sort of become sort of bifurcated? That means two sections.
Yeah, I didn't know what that meant. I was going to say what I was getting at was that whole idea of alternative comedy, because I remember that is like that was the whole idea of alternative comedy was that these people were not getting booked at the regular comedy clubs, and that they started their own scene, which is all well and good, and that was definitely the scene of the writers and the sketch artists and the actors and like the people who were doing things that weren't either the club owners or the club crowds were not getting, which is fine. And now that's kind of bled together as we've become like less of a drunken brawling crowd. Yeah. You know, the knife fight of late night club comedy is kind of down, you know, people don't do that. But what I was going to say is that like when I did the open mics, the whole idea was like, I think people come to open mics now like because when they ask me on the street as I'm smoking a cigarette, like comedy questions, you know, like some guy wants to be a comic, like he'll go like, you know, should I stick to my character, and like this is what I'm talking about, they're not getting. It's like I didn't think of character or talking about things until about like 8 years in.
Yeah.
I was thinking of like writing jokes and being consistently funny,
right,
which I think now is really almost like people find that corny and
right,
almost like, you know, look at this guy trying so hard.
Right.
But back in the day, that's how you got booked.
Right.
And that was really how you knew how you were doing, where you'd go on multiple times in open mics, and you listen to the laughs or the no laughs,
right,
and then you go like, wow, I have to change that, or like, oh, this joke would work better here, and all that kind of stuff. So it was all that mental chess game going on. But now I'd say that consistency and the ability to work in any...
Hey, guys.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, George.
What a weird, what a weird celebrity drop-by.
George.
But I'd say that whole thing of like being consistent and also like being what we do, because I think you and I are kind of cut from the same late night,
yeah,
kind of like, you know, we're on after the show is really over,
right,
and we kind of like love and hate that,
yeah,
you know, which is like,
I like the challenge.
Earlier would be better, but later is more fun,
yeah,
but sometimes it's a drag,
yeah, because it's hard to get a gauge later truly on if a joke is good, and then sometimes if you go on late, and we go on late a lot, and a lot of times we're back,
and you know
back.
Why you go on late, right?
Yeah, I don't know,
because at this club, especially the Comedy Cellar, since I would like to think that I'm one of the plank owners, I'm one of the founders of the late night comedy scene here,
yeah,
is that you went on late because either you were too dirty or no one could really follow you.
Right.
And like they would always go, no one can follow you. And then I'd be like, that's not true because I've seen a million people follow me. Right. It's because I'm too dirty.
Right.
And now that like the dirtiness kind of like is filtered throughout the whole show,
right,
it's really because... they know you can do it.
Yeah.
Like whatever happens at that point, they know you can handle it.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, you're a great guy, you know, like whatever, you know, here's a donut and a cup of coffee. Like you're the guy cleaning up after a hurricane.
Yeah,
you're a
exactly.
hero.
Exactly.
I don't need to know you're
exactly.
Get
but then
here.
If you're trying to get ready for a TV set,
it's impossible.
Yeah. Because you can't get a gauge and you're following somebody that either just blew up the room or whatever, or they're tired or they're drunk. But you know, you said something about working open mic nights and why you work in this sort of like really tight short form punch 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 is because, and it really resonated with me because I think I like to play with the crowd, and the reason I do that is when I was doing open mic nights they were drunk, and the way to get their attention was I'd talk to them, fuck with them a little bit, then I'd have their focus, then I'd slip in a couple of jokes as opposed to trying to just talk over the do jokes over the talking.
Sure.
And you said your form of what you do is a byproduct of the open mic nights and the same kind of thing, the late night shows.
The late night shows.
Where you thought, bang, quick, 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 so you get their attention, keep their attention, otherwise you lose them with stories or longer jokes, right?
Yeah, like when you know, we were talking about doing a podcast, and like I always try and think back to like there was that time in the 80s, like when I was working the door at the Improv with Kevin Brennan and you know, a couple other guys, and like Reggie McFadden, and like these guys, and like we would watch these guys go on, and these guys were the guys who were like the big names of New York. Mm-hmm. They weren't big comedy names, mm-hmm. but this was after Seinfeld had already, I've said this on other podcasts, so I'm sorry if this isn't new, but I was like looking at
you
their
know
acts.
What? You're a hack guest.
Yeah, I am. You know what? It's like I'm like the Merv Griffin guest. My three stories.
And that's it.
Bring out the tiger cub. Let's see some silliness. No, so I was gonna say that like you know, I would watch all that stage time being wasted because they weren't doing anything, and then I would also watch like these incredibly bad crowds kind of like abuse anybody who was. Yeah. And I guess that's what formed this kind of world. But I never like went into that alternative world,
yeah.
which is like, those were cooler shows. Mm. There were cooler people. Mm. There was a cooler hang. And I was like kind of dug in with the club world. And but, like, I always felt that like, you know, this was the stuff, like if a joke worked at a shitty night, a shitty whatever, right. it would work anywhere in the country.
Right.
But if it worked at an alt show at like 9 o'clock, then it would never work anywhere else. And I've seen that on the road, and I was almost like, these guys are like, you know, fencers in the age of gunpowder. Like, they're like, it's beautiful. It's kind of silly and witty and crafty, but at the end of the day, these rubes, these farmers, these carnies aren't digging it. And they're like, you know, it was like really hard to watch when I would see these alt guys go on the road. And they would immediately pull back to like, whoa, you know, I don't know what's going on. And then you would never see them on the road
for
another
exactly.
10 years.
And then judge the crowd. But like, you said that when you go on stage, we go on stage as comics, with like, you have a perception of yourself as a character, and every night is a conversation, and the audience is telling you or changing your perception of yourself, and then you go home and have to think about
that. I said
that? Yeah. It's really great.
I don't think I did say
no,
that.
No, you shut up. I read it. I know what I'm doing.
No, I think that the audience controls the show,
yes.
and that it's up to you to kind of wrangle the audience, and that...
They have all the power. You can't let them know they have.
Yeah, but that's the beauty of it, which is that like there is such a thing as like not caring what the audience
right.
does, and like I'm lucky that like at this point I don't care. Like I'd rather make you laugh and the waiter and waitress laugh
you
than
care.
The audience. I'm on the road and it's my crowd. Oh, I pull it out. I totally want them to have a great time.
Everybody listen. Like Eric, the guy who's listening, he's full of shit. He works on the jokes before he gets up. We talk about jokes off stage. You care. That's the artist.
I try and like, especially when I'm in New York, and Kevin Brennan will back me up on this, because like when we both started the road, I would come back to New York and like I would do all this like half-ass new stuff, and there was a lot of guys who were like new, like especially at this club, like Louis mm-hmm. and like Mark Maron and Nick DiPaolo and all these guys, because I don't remember seeing you until way later.
Yeah.
Like you were like the third, you were after Giraldo and Gaffigan. You were after those guys,
yeah.
you know, and like, you know, Russ Meneve, all these guys. And like we would come in and we would talk jokes. Mm-hmm. I mean, like now it seems to be everybody talks what they have to talk about, social media. And like, you know, Last Comic Standing and what's the seat, you know, how do you, you know, what pilots are going on. But it was a lot of joke talk, and it was a lot of fun, and it was also like a lot of you know, I think it was like really cool, because it was like you know, like we all like were kind of like pulling towards the same thing of like writing material, and some of us were better at it than others, some of us were better performers than others, and that was another thing I was going to say with the open mics, is that I wasn't a natural performer, you know, I mean, I was not.
You still aren't.
Yeah, you know what? I'll give you that, because like I know what performance looks like, and like I failed to do it, and like I always see like you know, the comics who perform. I was always like, when I first started, I was like, oh, okay, I'm on stage, that's balls, and like I'm nervous and I'm tanking, and then like I start writing some jokes, and then like the jokes aren't hitting because like I don't know how to perform,
right.
you know, and then it became like this whole thing of like, jokes are here, performance is here, and I'm raising my hands for Eric who's listening at home, so like that.
Well, you said the first 10 years is strong for material, and the second 10 years is strong for performing. And
that is racist.
And you don't like blacks or Asians. And but I mean, I didn't quite understand what you meant by that, or if you, I don't know if you remember saying it, but you did say it. But the point is like
that what the first that, 10 that, years
the first
for what?
For material, it's the strongest for material, but you're not a strong performer, and then it flips in the second 10 years. You're just saying, I think, you've got to sort of grow into being on stage, because it's such a weird thing to go up. You don't have it. You're not hiding behind a character as an actor, or an instrument as a musician, or behind a song that you wrote. So it's literally like, how do you get comfortable doing that? I get that question all the time, and I just say you got to go up a shit ton, because it's not a natural thing to be in front of people like that. Mm-hmm.
I know for me it wasn't, because I wasn't like in Pitch Perfect. I wasn't a high school a cappella singer or anything like that. But for me, I would say that being on stage, I also from Long Island, so Governors was a great place to see real road comedy.
Yeah.
Where super blue collar, super silly, super ethnic. Mm. If you're Italian, you better give me some Italian stuff.
Right.
If you're a black guy, I want to hear how hard it is to fight the man.
Right.
If you're a Jew, there better be some Jew jokes.
Right,
there.
Right.
So it was a lot of that stuff, and the crowd there, because the crowd was pretty hot at that point, in the late 80s, whatever. That was the first place I ever went on stage, and I really did tank hard. And I will say that the guys who rocked that scene, a lot of them are road guys, just because you're on the road doesn't mean you're not bitter. And these guys were kind of bitter, but Kevin James, and there was a couple other really good guys who came out of that world. Yeah. But I would say that that was another place where you learned to handle a crowd,
right.
Because, the majority of the people who come to these shows don't really know what they're coming to see.
Right.
Now it's even worse because, back in the day, there was no real... where you could watch a clip or illegally download an album. There, it was either you knew what comedy was or wasn't. And in between that was the stars of comedy. Dice, Rodney Dangerfield, people
Kinison.
Like that.
Kinison. Yeah.
And people would go expecting some
of
that.
And knew what they were going
to
get.
But they would see those three or four things. And then they would come to a club and they would expect that experience. And that's still happening today now, where they want to see a star. They want to see a big
right.
name. And you can't blame them. But... for the rest of us, we're kind of fill in the void, for these people who are not really the comedy fans.
No, but you have it. You have your
my fans
yeah.
who are great. And, I hate using the word fans or anything like that. But the people that come see me are great. Now they're older, because a lot of them kind of knew me from the Insomnia show.
Mm.
And then a lot of them realize that, he is a comic. So we might as well
that. He's not just an alcoholic with a show.
Yeah. So, some of them are into that. And then there's, a little bit of a new wave of people who just, dig comedy. But they get it. They like jokes. They drink hard. They don't really cause any trouble. They're good. When I talk to them in the crowd, they don't get all shut down and upset.
Right.
And they're fun that way. And I'm very lucky that they still come out to see me. And I'm not just saying that because aw shucks, Rick Springfield, humble or anything like that. I mean, they really are a good crowd, because every comic who's on my show goes, wow, your crowd is good.
Yeah.
I mean, they're really they like it tough.
Well, but
that's hard to find nowadays, as I'm sure you agree.
Yeah, but I think audiences, I said they may not be IQ smart, but they're emotionally smart. They know if you're bullshitting them, they know if you have a good act, and if you don't, they don't have to be experts at it.
I don't believe any of that.
And I think
that they're emotionally tough.
No, I think they're smart. I think audiences have great instincts.
Okay, I think that they smell fear. Have you ever done an urban show?
Yeah.
If you go up there nervous, they will destroy you.
Oh yeah, I was doing in one in Chicago. I was headlining. There was a middle act from Cincinnati, a white kid, and black audiences a lot of times when they laugh like this. Oh, you did not.
Yeah.
And the guy would do a joke, and they do that, and he thought that they were getting pissed at him, and then he went, and then he literally was apologizing on stage, and they ate him up.
Oh,
you have
they
to
hate
go,
that, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, we can agree to disagree, but I think an audience senses emotionally, if someone's full of shit or not.
Oh,
I really do.
I don't think they're emotionally tough in terms of on their side of the equation, which is that.
I don't use the word tough. I mean,
okay.
Perceptive.
Okay, yeah, right. They can smell
you
whatever
you, you
joke.
You don't agree?
No,
Dave, it's my
I
show. You're supposed to agree.
Well, I thought you were talking about they're emotionally tough and they could roll with the punches. Meanwhile, if you'd say any
oh,
kind of
no.
like. Yeah, no, they, not at all.
No,
I mean,
no, no.
These poor people, and I'm just going to say it that way, which is that they've been, they live in a world of filters, but filters for reasons where at work, they're not allowed to say certain things, in their own, whatever, their schools, their synagogue, church, or whatever,
right.
madrasa, they're not allowed to say certain things. And they know that there's ramifications for saying and almost thinking things, because we live in this world of political correctness.
Right.
So that when they come in the club, letting them get, saying to them, now they can say, laugh at things,
right.
is almost impossible.
Right.
And the reason why is because there's a generation gap now between... the younger generation, where they've been brought up on the media, and they know, and they know, they've been empowered by the media
and
they know
social
that,
media.
They know that they can react and contribute without consequence. And then there's the people of our generation where it's like, you know, you got something to say, you stand up and you say it. And if you got something to say to somebody, you say it to their face.
Right.
And that kind of thing is like, that really is the filter, which is like, hey, I'm going to say this to you about your shirt in the club, and the guy's going to stand up and want to come on stage and punch me.
Right.
And that to me was like, you know, part of like, you know, that was the comedy, you know, that was like, as you could say, like, the battle of comedy.
Yeah.
Is that like some guy, you insult his lady or she's drunk and you say something. And he comes up on stage and he might take a swing at you. You're like, that was like part of it. Almost like the bragging rights of like, you know, the war stories.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, and
nowadays, I think there's a lot of like, I'll just shut down and let this guy like kind of like make a fool of himself by talking to me.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And it's like, oh, you won that battle by looking all nervous. Right. And like making no eye contact, right. You know.
So. And so what I'm finding is now you can't even acknowledge the reality of something. Like if I say to somebody, sir, you're black, and everybody will be like,
yeah.
Do you look, and a lot of times like a light-skinned Dominican will look Puerto Rican, and anybody will tell you that, right? I don't mean that as a joke.
This
and I'll
is
say,
very you, inappropriate you know, after the Mets loss.
Right, exactly. And people will literally gasp, and I have to say to the audience, I don't care. You're telling me now, this. I think comedy, stand-up comedy, is the last bastion of an unedited speech, right? In a pure sense, if you don't like what I'm doing, don't rehire me, and you can boo me
right.
off the stage, right?
Right.
It's very clean and simple that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we should let anybody lose sight of that. So does it swing back, right? Does the pendulum swing back? Especially for a guy like you, you've said you like to push the envelope, make it uncomfortable, sometimes bomb intentionally to see if you can get yourself
out
of it.
Well, I'm working on the joke,
right.
You know, because I think that there's the joke, and then there's the execution of the joke, and then there's the audience's reaction to the joke, and the three of those things. But I'm not going for like, you know, I used to work with all these comics, and they would go like, I've never bombed. And like right now they're professional dog walkers somewhere, or they're working in their cousin's bakery. And like they were right, they never bombed because they never pushed it.
Right.
They knew the 12 jokes that worked, they knew the two like crowd things they're supposed to say, and then they would end with like some kind of guitar or hypnotism.
Right.
And I was like, you know what, you're right, you're a performer in the vaudevillian style of this is your act.
Right.
And now you got to catch a train to Topeka, you know. But for the rest of us where it was like, you know, you want to keep pushing it and pushing
right.
it. That's where like it became almost, I guess you could say that's the drug of it. You know,
yeah.
That really is like seeing how far you can push it.
Right.
But like what I've seen you do, which I think is balls to some degree, which is that you confront them, you know, and you won't let it go.
Right.
See, I'm not balls like that, which is like, I've learned through the decades of doing it, which is that like, There's such a thing as painting an audience member into a corner, and like you don't ever want to do that,
right.
And like you never want them to leave the show going like, wow, he really did like, you know, eviscerate me, and now people think that like, wow, he really was giving me shit when it really was just like, hey, nice shirt, Harry Potter. It was like one of those like
right.
lame ass,
right,
you know.
Right, right, right.
It's like, wow, thanks a lot, dude.
Yeah.
You know, but what I like to do is like, what I like to see when you do it is like, you hold on, like you get what you want out of these people.
Yeah.
I'll bounce
yeah.
all over.
Yeah.
And I realize that the more questions I ask, the more I'm slowing down my own thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm doing that now either out of laziness or just because I'm searching.
Yeah. So. How do you get yourself out of laziness? Because we all do that, right? I mean, even though you work a ton
Easy.
Of shit.
A double mortgage.
Nice.
When I bought a house for my mom and my own mortgage. That really
You bought a house for your mom?
It. Yeah.
Good for you.
I think
You're
that's
loaded. Why don't I have it? I should ask you for money. My kids got to go to college.
I never make any of those, whatchamacallit, Fortune 500. No. When I bought a house for my mom, and it's a very small house.
Mm. It's a dog house.
It's a dog house.
No.
It's
but it has a porch.
I go, Mom, I bought this house for you. It's a bus station. Go in there and make yourself at home. No, I think that like as you get older in comedy, you realize that like there's a real life that you have to have or you should have, and like. You know, then becomes not as much fun as when you're like living on the cheap and like, you know, just basically doing comedy.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know what you think about it. Like, I mean, I give you guys a lot of credit, the guys with the families that like, you know, being away all that time and like, you know.
You know, it's just an understanding we have, right? And my son would rather not see me anyway because I like to hit him. So, you know,
And I think that you're a great dad. I think that you're a show him one time, I'll show you again, and then you leave the room cursing.
There you go. I swear a lot. He won't let me see his balls.
What's that?
He's got hair under his arm.
How old is your son?
He's 13. He's got hair under his arms. And I know he's got it on his balls because I could see it through the shower door, right? It's right. One of those, you know.
This is inappropriate.
Right. Go ahead. So he's been on my podcast. We've talked about it. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, let me see. And I was a swimmer growing up, and we would swim naked, and we'd see each other in the like communal showers. And he won't let me see his balls. Now, you're a man that talks a lot about balls and beads.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't you think that's appropriate for a father to be able to see his son's balls? I'm not going to go up and like tickle them or cup them.
Why don't you take them like my dad did, take me to play racquetball and then just shower afterwards? That was like our big moment. We go play racquetball. I don't think anybody plays racquetball. Is that illegal now?
No, I think black people who want to come off white do.
I don't know. You used to see that in every movie too. Like the guy would get a phone call as he's playing racquetball. I always thought that was very cool. Well, your son is 13. Let me ask you a question. Do you think he's going to be a comic? Because
no.
He's something good.
No, because he's like.
Aren't you
mother.
Happy about that?
Yeah, I am. I mean, you know, would you really, if your son, if you had a kid?
Yeah, I would not.
Why?
Yeah.
So tell me.
I think
this
is not really a world. This is not really a good world. You know, there's so much disappointment. Mm. There's also so much like when you think about like.
So why do you stay in it?
Well, this is all I can do, but I would.
You're
hope
full of shit. You're a smart
son
guy.
Be one of the most successful cantors or rabbis or another job that.
What is it with you Jews? Why can't you go outside your faith and let the kid do something that's not Jew-like, like work at a pizzeria? But no, but you're smart enough to do whatever you want. You do this shit like, oh, I'm not smart. You went to NYU. You're personable when you want to be, which is like once a year.
Right.
But you're personable.
Yes.
Why don't you stop? Are you chasing something that you haven't gotten yet?
It's my life. I'm in it. Mi loca vida, I believe is what they
call it. Do you get
aggravated
about like, Dave, when are you going to have another TV show, your own TV show? You get that all the time.
And
it's
know.
Not enough to just be, that's the other thing now, especially with social media, I think. Like, it's not enough just to be a great stand-up. Like, people talk to you like there's something wrong with you if you're just a great stand-up and you don't have 4 million YouTube followers or you don't have a TV show.
Yeah, well, I think it's always been that way to some degree, but now I think it's funny, personally, but for you guys who are like, you know, like, I know that you're a self-starter, and I know that, like, you've had some experience in television, that you've put yourself out there in multiple media and stuff like that, and it's very frustrating, because a lot of, like, for me personally, I was very lucky to do a couple of projects that, like, I was able to be myself, and that, to me, is more important than, like, if I was the greatest actor and I had a story arc on Law and Order or something like that. Like, I have no desire for any of that attention. And also, learning someone else's lines, I realized, like, because I've had auditions and I've been in two or three things. It's like, I was like, I spent all this time trying to be myself, thinking about my own thoughts, my own perspective and stuff like that. And now they pulled me into some part that Jack Black was too big to do or some other, you know, like, likeable lug, you know, kind of thing. Like Artie Lang and I would always talk about that. Like, you know, bring him in because Farley's dead.
Right.
You know, bring this guy in. Bring you know. And I was like, it's like I have no desire. And like I would spend the whole time going like, this scene could be funnier if they put this guy here. And like, you know, like so in my head I was like,
start
redirecting the director.
Right.
And I was like, I'm not into it. Like I'm just not into all the work that goes into movies and TV.
But you have the
people don't even know that. Like, have you ever been on a movie set?
Oh God, yeah.
You see the 30 people just hanging around these grips.
Yeah.
These kids, like these. There's always that one girl, like you know Claire. She's hanging around, like you know. She's like, I don't know, man. You know, like you don't even know, like it's like steampunk girl, you know. And like, thank God for tattoos because otherwise you would never know who's not working on the shoot. Like, you know, unless a guy's got like a full tilt spider neck tattoo, I'm like, okay, he must be the lighting guy, you know. But like, the only job that I love on movies are the director, and then the craft service guys. Those are the only guys who look like they're having a great time.
Yeah, right.
They're like, up. Hey, we got, you remember those waffles? They're hitting on, like, the extras, you know? Remember those waffles you said you like? Well, I bought, like, 1,000 of them. You can have those. He's, like, having fun with them. And then the, whatchamacallit, the director guy seems to be having a great, in his madness, you know?
But you have the resources to do a scripted self-serialized reality, whatever. Not a reality show, but, like, sort of.
Everybody belittles the people who really do it because they feel like, you know, it's really hard being a TV writer. It's really hard being an actor. And, like, why be half-assed at it when I'm pretty good at this now? Like, it took me years to get pretty good at this. So, like, you know, when I look at, like, movies, I never go, you know, I could have played that part. Or when I like, I was just watching, you know, I don't really watch comedies. I don't know if you
Gone
do.
Gone with the Wind? You think you could
No, I watch a lot
one?
Of dramas, and I'm like, you know, I never could write something like this. Like, right. I don't know, like, the A, B, and C story.
But
and
you
like,
could write your life and film it, not as a movie, but as a
but
TV
who cares?
Series.
Like, I don't have a desire for
well,
that
who cares
kind of
about Louis? I mean, Louis or any other show like that?
Well,
who
first
cares?
Of all, Louis, talk about the guy who, like, a Cinderella story, because, you know, he kept going and going at it, yeah. And he developed these skills. He never went to film school. He never went to, and I've said this on multiple podcasts. It's like, you know, there's the learning. There's the everybody's waiting for some kind of like someone to make it happen for them.
No, it's never going to be
for guys like Louis and stuff like that. There was the desire and the and also just like I guess you could say like that amazing like ability to like you know just like. Like, I guess you could say learn by doing.
Well, you have to be
great.
More entrepreneurial now than ever because if you tie
what's
it
what's your end game?
My end game
I mean,
is to have my
I
own
network.
I came
here and I said, here's a sitcom, all right? Here's a sitcom. You're on the sitcom, right? You're on it for 7 years. All the stuff, great stuff has happened. Then what do?
I'd tour.
Yeah, so then you'd be back on the road.
I'd be happily
so what
touring.
If I said the sitcom's on for 7 weeks? Mm-hmm. Now you're going to tour and also answer a lot of morning radio questions about why it tanked.
but if you... here's the thing that sort of...
There's nothing... You know that Benghazi thing? Mm. Like, that's like after you've been on a failed show, like when you do morning radio, they fucking attack you. Like, it's like, so what happened there?
Why did
I
you...
I was like, you didn't even watch your show.
Weren't you sick of people asking you why you stopped doing Insomniacs?
Oh,
you want to blow your brains
people
out, right?
always ask me about that. And now that I look at all the shows that are travel shows, and I go like... You know, one, I'm jealous that we never had the access that these people do. Like, we never could go to Beirut.
Yeah.
We never could go to, you know, like, I remember we went to Germany and we had to, like, you know, sign a waiver and get, like, the Pope to, like, bless the equipment. And, like, everyone's so, like, I don't know, do you think they'll get it? Yeah. And I'm like, this is what it's about. It's supposed to be, like, traveling the world.
Right.
You know? And, like, to be honest, you know, I would think that, like, that's a young man's sport. Like, there's a couple of reality shows. I was kind of hoping you would ask me this because now I'm starting to watch a lot of them. Mm. There's these shows now that, like, I always thought that the key to my show was the late night jobs. That was, like, the one thing that kind of gave it this kind of, like, it's a real thing. And those were real jobs. And the majority of these shows now are all about jobs.
Right.
They're all job related.
Right.
And, like, the real hero of these shows is the editing because... Most of these jobs are not that interesting.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But because we live in a world where, like we were talking about phones and like social media, seeing somebody really do something with a return at the end is like almost like porn.
Listen.
Like, I'm going to tell you to watch this show called Forged in Iron. Now, I know it sounds like an old karate movie, Lou Gossett movie, kind of. Forged in Iron, it's about competitive blacksmithing. And I was like watching this thing. It's like, I don't know anything about blacksmithing, but now I'm like, I want to know everything about it.
Because
I was like, look at these manly guys go at it.
Right.
You know, it's like.
Well, it's like that show, How It's Made. Do you ever watch that?
No. Yeah. I love that show.
I like watching it. It relaxes me. And it's literally like, I watched them one day make hand dryers that are in
restaurants. Right.
And it literally is like, oh, yeah. And I was completely engrossed. And you're right. I don't think we have that anymore. Did you?
I hate comedy. I'll tell you why. Because. Comedy always leaves you with, like, I don't know if you feel this way at the show, but you're like, oh, I shouldn't have said that, or the joke should go this way, and blah, blah, blah. But the good thing about comedy is, like, you can go back up.
Right.
You know, it's like if it was a play or something like that, it would be different.
Right.
If it was a movie, you'd be like, oh, that's how it is.
Right.
You got to stay with it. And that's the cool thing about, like, especially the jokes I like, which is, like, my jokes change.
Yeah.
Like, I can, you know, flip them around, add a tag, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That's the, like, you know, I guess you could say... That's kind of like the, you know, gravy of being a comic is that, like, you can always win it back.
Isn't it frustrating, though? Like,
but there's no return. There's no at the end where you're like, I nailed it, and a clown starts shooting candy out of his mouth, and you're like, oh, I won.
Well, you know? Brian Regan says it would be it'd be boring if you went up and killed every night, right? I mean, and I think that's essentially, in some way, what you're saying, right? Like, I was just on the road, and I had a killer Thursday, Friday, first show Saturday, sold out, big... And I couldn't, they just would only come to a certain level of excitement, right? Like, I couldn't.
Do you think that was you or them?
I think it was probably a combination. I'm never one of these people that want to blame the audience 100%.
Right.
I think it's a relationship and a conversation between me and the audience, and their side of the conversation is laughter.
Is that really what you think when you're standing on top of that piano screaming at people? You're having a conversation.
Yeah, I do.
It looks like a guy on Wall Street in the 80s coming up.
Oh, go up.
Fuck IBM, you know.
Well, but I get animated, but that doesn't mean I'm angry. I'm just animated and emotional. But you don't think the conversation... I think it's a conversation between the audience and the comedian. It always is.
I'll tell you what it is. Leadership. I'm the fucking leader.
Right.
Either they go with me across the Red Sea, or else they're going to die.
Why
under
do you want
to?
Sometimes you want to push the audience away. Why do you do that?
No, what I like to do, especially now, because we live in such a PC world. Like,
right.
Like now you're an edgy comic if you just say, you know, whatever. I ate meat.
Right.
You know, whatever. So, you know, what I like to do is basically, first of all, survive, which is what it always is about. Then, like I said, you know, like. I've been working here 1,000 years now, so you know, the staff is very. if we kind of talk about something before, I try and work it in so that they'll have a laugh.
Right.
But the majority of the people here are from other countries, and I think that they're tourists. So like, there is some good to like performing to other people. Like it's kind of interesting, but we always hit with the same, you know,
right.
Like you know, stereotypes. You know,
right.
Hey, you're from this place,
right.
So this happened.
Right.
But I try and like go past that now a little bit. You know?
Are you? Being dirty, which I think, like you said, you early on, was that specifically also in reaction to the audiences in the late night shows or the open mic sort of not focused, and that was a way to kind of shock them into focus?
I don't know. I look back at some of the earlier jokes and I go like, the dirtiness had its place. It wasn't just, you know, we've all been on the road where they have like, you know, like the local middle, mm-hmm. and he just comes up and basically just, you know, wipes his balls on the stage. I mean, like, it's just like, wow.
Right.
And I'm like, there's no joke there.
Right.
There's no joke there. And there's, in comedy, there's the, you know, like, the guy who fake fucks the stool.
Right.
Like, there's those
things.
That
was the guy who got a $500,000 development deal.
Right. Well, those are the things that you're like, you know, like, hey, well, I'm not doing that, so I guess I'm closer to PBS, right? I don't know. But I think that the, like Mitch Hedberg gave me a good comment once. He goes, "You're dirty, but it's smart dirty." And I was like,
yeah.
"Wow!" Because this guy, like nobody could write a joke like that guy. So and everybody tried. And that's something I'll fight anybody on. No one can write like that guy, but everybody's trying.
Yeah.
And like you know, I would always go to Mitch. I go like, you know, Mitch, you know, because like, you know we partied and everything. And I go like, Mitch. You know, whatever, what if you did like a TV, like you got a call tomorrow to do this TV show? And it'd be like, he was so smart because he partied at such a rock star level, yet his material was always TV clean. He never would have to change a word.
Right.
Koala bears. It works on any show. He could have done Nickelodeon if
right.
he wanted. Meanwhile, we'd always come, you've done late night TV,
yeah,
where
yeah.
they're like, ah, it's such a funny joke.
Right.
You cannot say that.
Right.
You can't use taint.
Yeah.
You know,
one guy said to me one time, we need punchlines every 15 seconds.
Yeah, but you know what? I started doing that, where it's like, I would, like, my stuff is short like that, so I could give them that kind of thing. So then they would hammer me on something else. Like, my classic Letterman thing was like, I used to have the one man, if I need directions, I'll ask a guy with one leg, because he knows the shortest way to get there.
Right.
If there's a shortcut, he knows.
Right.
And like, they go, you know what? This is kind of like, we don't know, the one-legged man thing, you know, it could piss off.
We have a big demo.
We have a big, of pirates, of whatever, of Civil War reenact, you know. So I was always like, that's not fair, because the week beforehand, there would be like a better, more famous comic on, and they'd be like, I'll pull that fucking one, you know, like
right.
they would be no.
But you have to earn
censorship.
That right.
Yeah, well, that was the thing, that you had to earn the right. And then I remember that, like, I became one of these guys. Like, there's a lot of young guys now where, like, they're doing multiple talk shows. Like, Nick Griffin and, like, you know, like, Mike Vecchione. All these guys are great joke writers.
Mm.
And they go on. And it's because, like, these shows know, they're like, oh, we need someone who can write some jokes
right.
to do this, you know, thing. And I've seen when they've had, like, more of the, I guess you could say, alt-y people on these shows, and like it's a whole different spot
because they're used to telling stories in those alt rooms. They can get away with that. And
you have to get them right away.
You have to get them right away, and you have to keep them. You have to keep hitting them, hitting them, hitting them. And the alt guys aren't.
They're not built that way.
They're not built that way in those rooms. If you
that's the back conversation with the audience,
right? And if you start trying too hard, then they are going to sort of go away on you, right? In an alt room, if you come off in an alt room like you're trying too hard to be funny, ironically, they'd be like they can kind of shut down and go, "Dude, you're trying a little too hard." Like you almost have to do it like, "Oh no, this just happens to be funny. I didn't plan on this being funny."
Right.
And therein lies the problem of like sort of this shell game a little bit. And I don't like playing the shell game. And I'll work some alt rooms and I'll just go up and do what I do in a regular club because I think you should be able to do both. But but now you were talking about Mitch, and there were a lot of guys doing Mitch, and there's some guys that do you, not literally, but you know they have your rhythms and everything. Do you ever, is that cool with you? I mean, it's got to be a compliment on some level, but
I don't think what I do is particularly, I mean, I don't know. I mean, people have brought that up to me a lot, but I think that I'm kind of like the default setting on an iPad.
No.
Trying to make it hip. No, I don't know. I mean, like, I've seen guys who like kind of have the same thing, but I would feel that like, you know, there's nothing you can ever like say to somebody like that. And the other thing is that like I'm supposed to be moving forward in what I'm doing, right? So it's like, you know, it's like, hey, you're doing my thing, you know. It's like I don't know what to say, but I know when I first started, like I looked up to Colin Quinn, and like there was a couple of guys, like Havy was another guy.
What was it about Colin and Havy?
Colin was the smartest. He was the smartest. He was the one guy, Colin and Havy, and there was a couple other guys that really were like, you know, when they did it, when they did the stage, especially like here or at the old Catch Rising Star, like you could tell that like they were having a good time, they were in total control. Talk about crowd mastery! Like all the crowd work that we all do is really an offshoot of what they've done, with the whole like, you know, hey, you look like a that and that kind of thing. Like their original take on that was really what I think we all watched.
Right.
And like, you know, I'm sure there was people before them doing that. You know, I'm not sure if Chaplin did it, but you know, at the end of the day, that like their ability to like do like great jokes and also make the room part of the show was cool to see. And Colin especially is like, he's really a talented guy. I mean, like he's super smart.
He's so prolific.
I mean, yeah, and like I think for stand up for him, like few people like got a chance to really see him as a stand-up. He never really did an hour special.
Right.
He's done one-man shows, which is harder than an hour special. And, like, you know, I remember seeing one of his one-man shows, like one of the early ones, and I'm like, you know, he's stuck to the script. He's in the moment. He's in character. He's doing his thing. And I was like, why isn't this guy working this crowd? Because, like, he can fucking totally, like, that guy up front who's, like, looking at his phone, he could totally destroy that guy, and then there's that girl wearing the hat.
Yeah, I know.
And it's like, he can't do that because this is, like, theater, you know?
Do you pull yourself out of talking to the crowd? I will sometimes to get back into material because you don't want to overdo talking to the crowd, or do you just sort of, is that sort of just, I'm done with this guy, I got the most out of it, and I'm going to move on?
Well, if you're talking about at the Comedy Cellar, this used to be a place where you could do a ton of new material. Now, because it's such a sensation, this is like a, you know, people come here from the airport with their rolling bags, which, you know, you can't ask for, you know, I mean, like, if it's that important, you know, like, get off the plane and get down here.
Right.
So I would say that it's not really that kind of place anymore. It's become more of a performance place, don't take chances kind of place, because you don't want to, like, you know, it can go bad quickly, especially if it's a tourist crowd, you know, so I would say for me, when I work the crowd, I want it to lead to like a new bit, unless I have to handle the crowd, which means they're talking or something like that. But there's a lot of laziness on my own part. I have a lot of bad habits on stage. Like I really do like feel that, like, you know, when I see these young comics where they don't recognize the crowd at all, I'm like, that's probably good, because like they're focused on their act, like they're preparing.
So what is your bad habit?
But I would say that like, no, like I'm always looking at the crowd. Even like when I'm on stage, I'm looking at everybody.
And you say they're preparing, meaning preparing for like a late night TV
for their amazing in their mind, whatever they're trying to do. No, they go up there with the material. They don't deviate from the material. But because the crowd, you know, as we both know, it's kind of like surfing. You know, like when you catch the wave right, everything will work. When you catch it wrong, it's going to take a real skilled surfer to get through the, you know, the reef.
Yeah. But it's also a wasted opportunity, I feel like, in a live performance to not engage the crowd in some level, because it gives them something that they can see on TV, somebody just doing set up punchline. You don't have to be in a live space to do it. So why not sort of bring that true live component to it without anybody being judgmental about it? You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I agree with you on that. I totally agree with you. And I would say that, like, you know, these younger, the younger comics today, like, have performed in front of different open mics than we did, where like, there's probably some rough and ready ones, and I'm sure there are, but the majority of them are these kind of, like, I guess you could say hoot nannies. Like, you see, the, you know, like, I performed this one show in L.A., and they were sitting on the floor Indian style, like, staring up at me, like, you know, it was camp or something. And I don't care who you are, but, like, you know, when you get in the club world or in the late night world, you're not expecting, like, you know, like, it's going to be some kind of, like, weaving, you know, like, people sitting around making bracelets or something. And that's, I guess that's what these kids, they're very good in a group. One-on-one, I'm not so sure, but in a group, they're okay.
Well, listen, we'll wrap up in a second. Do you think digital and the explosion of digital is good for us, for anybody? Because, you know, we were talking about the other night, we were talking about podcasts, we were talking about social media, how these comedy clubs on the road now don't want to really sort of use money to market themselves, which drives me fucking crazy, and a lot of them just rely on social media, which you can't do, and everybody thinks that's the be-all and end-all. Does it swing back? How does it shake out? And is digital sort of like, do you think that's a positive next new wave that you're going to try to ride and people should be trying to ride, or where does that shake out for you?
I don't know. I mean, I think those are all really good questions. And we did talk about that, that, like, you know, I see both sides of it. The club needs to fill the seats. You know, it's a real location. It's bricks, you know, like, they have to pay rent and all that kind of stuff. But then there's, you know, there's difference. There's a fine line between a club and a restaurant. And, like, sometimes you play some of these clubs and you go, like, you know, this, they seem to be more concerned about the restaurant aspect than, you know, you're just the guy talking.
The food and the booze.
And, like, the real good club, and, like, I like to think that I was formed by the clubs, like, you know, like, Jeff Wills and Mark Babbitt, these guys were, like, club, they ran clubs before they went on to other things. And, like, they really did, like, like, almost, I guess you could say, like, cut man the comics, you know, they were in the ring with the comics, you know, they were for the comics, and, like, they always took, and Manny, who, God rest his soul, he was always for the comics.
Manny was the owner of the comic cell.
And Noam, and I think his Noam son. And Esty and Ava and all the people who were involved in this know that how important the comics are to the club.
Yeah, otherwise, this place has a 3-drink maximum.
Otherwise, it's a Mideastern restaurant.
Right.
And that's really, you know, I mean, you know, that's so important when the owners get it. But in terms of the social media and what the comics have to do, there's never been more work to comedy. Like, you know, getting up for radio used to be the work of comedy. Yeah. Getting there was the work of it. Yeah. Now it's like, that is just another part of it.
Do you think the art of it suffers because of that? Because you can't, because you have to spend so much time away from the art of it that, you know, it was different, right, when you started out?
No, I would say that because I don't really like the web aspect of it at all, and I think that, like, we've spoiled the audience into thinking that, like, you know, they'll watch a couple of clips. Even talk shows now, like, they do all viral clips. Like, we've spoiled the audience that, like, you know, getting a moment of their attention is, like, you know, we should be so satisfied. And, like, in music and in comedy especially, where people are getting a lot of product for free, everybody suffers. Like, you are doing this thing. You're a businessman. You're your business.
Right.
And the majority of what you do, you don't get any return other than the fact that, like, you're doing it.
Right.
You know, and I'm all about, like, you know, not making my audience pay for expensive tickets and all that kind of stuff. And, trying to be as good a comic as I can and all that stuff. But at the end of the day, we need people to come from the web back into the clubs to build new comics. And also to, like, you know, for guys like us, like, this is what we do.
And you're saying there's no incentive to come off the web because it's, you click and you can see a gorilla fucking a sheep and whatever, and it's way more entertaining than going to see live comedy.
And it is. Let's settle it right here. That is more interesting.
You and I produced a series of those clips, but you're saying it's just you're competing against that, and live comedy can never match up against sitting in your pajamas at home fucking surfing the web and seeing the most disgusting and cool crazy shit.
Or, right.
And you, so does it ever swing back? How do we get them back in the clubs? Because that digital world's not going to change.
You see a lot of younger, I guess you could say, like, New York type millennials coming in, and, like, they, you know, heard about it or saw it in Louis' show, like, this club, and this is kind of like a cool thing to come and take a picture of yourself in front of the sign and all the thing. But do they really dig comedy? Probably 9 out of 10, not really. They'll go on to the next thing, whether it's like, you know, vampire roller skating or some other cool thing. But there's that 10th person that we really got to get come back and bring a friend who really will do it. And that's what keeps it alive and vibrant. And also for the younger comics, it's really important for them.
Well, I was bitching to my wife, like, the more successful you get, the less time you spend on the art and the more time you're spending on the business of it. Leno said one time, I don't get paid all this money to tell jokes on stage, just to put up with all the bullshit off stage. And I think there's a certain truth to that. And I feel like, you know, I have somebody who does social media, and I have an agent and a publicist, whatever, and a podcast now, and whatever. And I'm spending a big part of my day just managing all of that.
Yeah.
Where it used to be when we were starting, not to sound like an old man, like, you were focused most of the day on, okay, I got this 5 minutes I'm going to do. I'm going to move this around. I'm going to try this joke here instead of here. And I feel overwhelmed at times. And I don't have a massive budget where I can just have, like, a guy for $100,000 a year run everything, which is what I really like. So I don't...
So that's why your son comes into play. Yeah, you gotta raise him.
I know. So I don't know how it... I don't know how it gets better in that sense, because I feel like you have to be all things to all people. Like, if you go sell a show now, not you, but you in the third person, they're going to check your social media following. And that's going to factor into the decision if you want their... And now another guy's got a show with... Okay, so you've got 20,000. Another guy's got 1.5 million, and his show is watching a bowl of shit steam for 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. They're going to buy that show. Because the networks don't know how to get new people into the tent, because digital is you know, taking away a lot of viewership. So I think it's affecting the quality of some of the stuff that's getting done, because you just have to have a big YouTube following to get something on the air sometimes.
Yeah, that YouTube sensation thing, like, is the one thing that everybody, and, you know, this is kind of a good, like, full circle thing, which is like, the YouTube now is supposedly like the world's open mic, but it really isn't, because you know, these people, the followers will follow them, and they're following them now into the clubs, and the clubs are putting on shows for these YouTube people. And I always am curious. I'm like, how did that go? Like, what kind of people show up and all that kind of stuff? And the club owners usually are like, I don't know. They don't know. And they're not being, like, you know, cagey about it. They just don't get it yet. Nobody gets it yet.
Right.
That, like, these people are connecting on the web with these people, and these people are coming out to them. So it shows you that, like, you know, we're all super connected, but everybody's still super lonely. You know, like, it's kind of sad in a way. And like, as a loner, like, I see it as like, you know, if I'm going to watch something, I want it to be more than what I'm doing. And now it doesn't even have to be that. Like, the fact that you'll watch a guy, you know, go through his refrigerator and he'll look at stuff and talk about it. That to me is like genius and also weird of, like, you know, so why am I trying so hard?
Well, exactly. And then I feel bad. I feel shitty about myself. I was on the subway, and I keep seeing these posters for this chick. She's got like 2+ million followers. So I wrote it down. I looked her up, and I literally watched her 5 minutes talk about why she eats a certain kind of cereal. Then she went upstairs, she brushed her hair and the kind of makeup she puts on, and that was the video. And it had like 1.5 million views.
Yeah.
And I turned that off, and I turned to my wife, and I'm like, why am I, like, Why am I killing myself, right?
Yeah.
Why am I coming up with TV show ideas? Why am I working on a TV show? Why am I writing jokes and fucking doing 2 o'clock in the morning spots at the Cellar and trying to... What am I doing? Why don't I just start fucking filming myself brushing my balls, like, and fucking, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm not sure yet in my own mind if that's a good thing or a bad thing, you know? And I guess it's a question.
I'm very happy with my place in this business and, like, the things I've gotten to do. For you guys who are, like, still, like, hungry and trying to make the shows happen, not only just for the like, art of it, or the, you know, like, I guess you could almost say, like, you know, the game, like, you're still in the game.
Yeah.
I give you all the credit, because it's only harder than it ever was. Like you said, where they judge how many followers you have and where they're going to do it, and it's focus grouped and all that kind of stuff. You look at the shows of yesteryear and how, like, they kind of threw stuff up there, and it was kind of cool because they knew it was the right thing to do, like, you know, All in the Family and those kind of shows that, like, became these relevant shows.
Yeah.
Like, you see that, like, if they had focus grouped that and, like, totally had Twitter following, that would have been canceled by the first commercial break.
Exactly.
You know, Seinfeld, like, it would just been like, whoa, that's done. And, like, even Seinfeld says it. And, you know, he doesn't get enough credit because he really is an amazing joke writer, you know, in terms of the, you know, his place in the business.
You mean we get enough credit in what way? Because I feel like
I think that, like, his jokes, like, when I would watch him on Letterman, they were really, it was like going to school. Like, you could see, like, you know, like, they were very
technically that,
bang, bang, bang. And that, for me, in my head, it was very good for me to see, like, where a joke's supposed to go.
Right.
But his show, as he said, was like, you know, it was basically the first season was, you know, horrible, like, ratings and all that kind of stuff. But the idea, because it was so different, you know, it built the following.
They stuck with it, and they wouldn't do that to
And I think that that's amazing. And, like, when you look at Larry David, like, what a genius that guy was. It was like, you know, thank God that Seinfeld happened. I mean, like, so many big names in town.
Yeah, but the problem is with vertical integration and these corporations, now a network isn't a network.
You can't throw yourself into this world here. You know, like, you're like Tucker trying to reinvent the windshield wiper.
But it's like,
I mean, you know, that's the world it is. Now it's deciding whether you want to be a part of it or not, you know?
I got it. Listen, we should double date.
Well, I was going to say this, Paul, that, like, next time I do the Comedy Underground, and I'm not sure when we're going to do it, because now the Underground place is a huge hit, too.
Yeah.
You know? I'd love for you to be on it again. You were always good when you came by. Of course, I'll have to go last, because, you know, I need a strong close.
Right, exactly.
And I'm going to say it right now. Thank you for having me on your show. And
thanks,
two chairs and a microphone.
Yeah.
Check it out. For my tour dates, thanks for helping me out. You selfish.
No,
DavidTell.com. Go to my thing.
We're gonna do that. What else do you want me to plug? Because what I'll do is
I'll be at Caroline's over Thanksgiving.
All right. Okay. All right. Well, this may air after Thanksgiving, but we'll tell people anyway.
All right. Then I'll.
I will. No. I'm gonna. What I'm gonna do is I'm gonna.
New Year's.
I'm
I'll be at the cellar.
Yeah. I'm gonna record. I will record an intro, and I'll call you before I do, and we'll put whatever you want in the intro, and I'll say you can see Dave here, there, and everywhere.
Whatever.
Why do you have to produce my podcast?
No, I'm just saying, why are you making more work for yourself?
That's recording how I do my intro. Podcast.
I'm recording an intro.
All right, go get your kettlebells and work
Thank
out.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was David Tell. Brilliant comic, really fun. Could have talked to him all day. Dave rarely does those interviews, so I was really psyched to have him. Hope you enjoyed it. You got a kind of a window into a brilliant, twisted comedy mind. November 25th and 26th, don't forget, Gotham Comedy Club. I'm headlining 5 shows. Promo code Paul. Go to GothamComedyClub.com. Use that promo code, get half off. Hope you can make it. And spread the word about the podcast. Send the link around. A lot of people should hear this interview with Dave. And please go review the podcast on iTunes. Thanks, everybody. Catch you next week.